You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, December 1st, 2019, and we are live from Christchurch, New Zealand. This is your host, Stephen Novella, and joining me, as always, is my brother, Bob.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Christchurch.
We are just having so much fun on our trip here. We came a week early, basically, before the conference, and we were going on vacation with our families. This is our second time to New Zealand, first time to the South Island, and it is exactly as beautiful as we were promised. Mm-hmm. It really is absolutely amazing. I know you guys appreciate it, but maybe not as much as you should. It's funny how people don't, like, every time I talk to somebody about what we're doing this week, like, oh yeah, I should do that sometime. You know, like, a lot of people don't do the touristy things in their own backyard.
Yeah.
But you should. You should. You guys live here. So, you know, we had 100 pictures. You can't take a bad picture around here. It's just ridiculously beautiful. I mean, we were trying to drive from, like, Queenstown to Tekapo and say, oh, stop here, stop. Like, every place is a scenic overlook. Like, there's no place that's not a great place to take. We would never get anywhere if we kept stopping to take
pictures.
Remember,
we were driving up a hill, like, oh, let's stop here. Then we stopped here. And then we drove right by the actual like,
scenic overlook.
We had to get out there because that was the maximally awesome spot. Right?
So we're happy that we hit Peak Lupin, apparently, which lasts a couple of weeks here. These are just gorgeous flowers,
really?
And they're pretty much everywhere.
Just a couple of weeks? Wow.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks.
And they smell incredible.
They smell beautiful. I mean, again, it's like you guys are like, yeah, like we have flowers like this that bloom seasonally, you know, where we live, and they're pretty, but, you know, we don't get excited about them because we live with them. But trust me, this is exciting. These are gorgeous. Okay, we took a tour of Milford Sound. It was a misty, you know, just drizzly kind of day, which I think was perfect. Like, it wasn't raining too much to not enjoy it, but it created like a photographer's dream in terms of...
Well, the tour guide said out of all the weather that happens there, that this is the best because it gives you a good depth of field.
And yeah. all the waterfalls become active, essentially, during the wet time.
And you get diffuse lighting, which is what you want. Like, overcast is the perfect lighting for photography because it's basically a diffuser, right? So there's no harsh light, there's no harsh shadows, but it's bright enough to take these kinds of pictures. It's great. All right, so you guys know I'm into birds, so you knew that bird picture was coming, right?
Yeah.
This is, anybody who knows what kind of bird is on the screen behind me? Raise your hand if you recognize that bird. See, this proves my point. Not many hands went up. That is a Fiordland crested penguin. Fiordland crested penguin. Apparently, you don't see them every time you go to Milford Sound, but we got lucky and we did.
We saw quite a few of them.
Yeah.
That was the cutest thing that happened
They're
on this trip.
Adorable.
So the boat pulls up for no reason. The boat was just kind of going up to the shore here and there, like we're looking at stuff. And then we see these two little guys come out, right? They come bopping out, and they're falling down. And it was like a comedy routine. And at one point, Ian, our tech guy, goes, too cute. Too cute, like it was cute overload. It was ridiculous.
I was thinking, like, what's all the commotion? They're just penguins. I mean, what, you guys were just way excited, but I mean, once I got a good look, like, all right, they're pretty adorable.
Yeah. But not only, all right. So this is my
very
first penguin in the wild encounter. So that gets checked off my life list.
Yeah.
And this is the second rarest penguin in the world.
Ooh.
Second rarest, yeah. And you guys have them in your backyard. Go see them.
What's the first rare?
I don't know.
Batman's penguin. You barely see him at all.
No.
Yes. We went to Tekapo. That's the 1.8-meter telescope, which is big. That's a big telescope. And we've learned what they were doing. A couple of people were asking us yesterday about this. So they're looking for exoplanets, and they're using... There's multiple methods that we use to look for exoplanets. This telescope is using a micro-lensing technique. So what micro lensing is, it's using gravity like a lens. This is the, you know, Einstein's relativity, general relativity, you know, gravitational field will bend light like a lens. So what they do is they'll image a star field with millions of stars until two stars perfectly line up, right? And you have to look at millions of stars in order for this to happen. And when that happens, the nearer star will lens the light from the more distant star, and so that gets brighter because it's, you know, it's being magnified. The light's coming around, and more, it's coming at us from more different directions.
But basically amplifies the power of the telescope, right?
But what they're looking for is they're looking at the light curve, you know, and then when a star passes in front of it, you get a very typical light curve that is a lensing effect, right? But there may be an anomaly in that light curve where you get a lot of a second bump, right, in the light, and that's from an exoplanet.
That's crossing in front of the distant star, right?
It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to be transiting. So it could be in any configuration, because as long as it's in front of, its gravitational field will be in front of the more distant star, right? The advantage of this method is that it's the most sensitive method we have for detecting exoplanets, and also you can find smaller planets, a little bit smaller than Earth, they said, and more distant from the parent star. It doesn't have to be next to the parent star. The transit method works better. That's when a planet travels in front of the star and you're looking for a dip in the light. That works better for big planets close to the star. So we initially found a bunch of hot Jupiters, right? Jupiter-sized planets close to the star.
Because that's all you could find at the low level of technology where you can only detect
Yeah, but
big
when we
planets.
Put up Kepler and those, then we could see smaller planets more distant. But
it's
it
low hanging fruit, though.
But if the period is 5 years, it takes 10 years to confirm it because we need two periods to confirm it. But the lensing effect, you get it right there. It's like instantaneous. But that's also a downside because these are one-off events. That alignment of the two stars, it happens once. It doesn't come around again, right?
How brief is it?
It's brief.
I thought he said something about more than hours to days.
Hours. So then you have to get, like, other telescopes may try to look at it, you know, once you confirm it. But you basically get one chance to collect that data.
So the thing to do is to get as much data as you possibly
can. In the window,
And even if we can't analyze it properly now, in the future we may be able to analyze it in more detail with new technologies and find out even more information.
Yeah.
You just get as much as you can, and that's it. You will never see it again. I mean, maybe you would see it in a million years, but no one's going to wait.
We're going to try to power through a bunch of news items because, you know, we've been here. It's been a couple of weeks. A few weeks since we've recorded the show. There's been a lot of science news happening. This is the Dalal region of Ethiopia, which is near a volcanically active region. So this is a pool of water, very pretty, very like alien landscape. You can tell the colors like red, orange, green, yellow, all close together. That water is super hot because it's, you know, near a actively geothermal area. It's very hypersaline, very, very salty, and it's acidic. So it's like a triple threat. It's called a polyextreme environment. Hypersaline, hot, and acidic. Why I'm showing you this is because this is really like the first place on Earth where scientists have basically proved there's no life.
They've ruled it out.
Yeah, they've pretty much ruled out that there's any life in these pools. And there are extremophiles, right? Extremophiles are
bacteria,
mostly archaea, but also bacteria, microorganisms that adapt to extreme environments, hypersaline, like very salty environments, briny, very hot environments,
acidic.
Or very acidic environments.
Living in acid, basically.
Right. So this is really the first time we've found an environment that's so extreme, it's triple extreme, that there's no life there. But there's life all around, so it's not as if life doesn't have access to it. It just can't penetrate into this environment.
Aren't you disappointed in the extremophiles? I mean, I really thought they could do something. They could pull this off. I would start breeding them to see if they could.
They already are. I mean, think about it. They're evolving closer and closer to this extreme environment.
Guys,
they may be pushing deeper and deeper.
No, but I mean, like, do some genetic engineering.
No, you don't want that because then it turns into like the xenomorph from Alien.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Which
be cool.
We don't want.
That'd be cool.
Think tardigrades could live there?
No.
They would live there if they could live there.
They would be there if they could.
So they looked for them.
Yeah, remember, tardigrades exist in extreme environments when they're desiccated, when they're dehydrated, like spores.
But usually they're like in pond scum.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where you'll find them.
So anyways, what's interesting about this is that because we have a gradient, right, there's like the environments get more and more and more and more extreme, it gives us a way of seeing like how extreme an environment can microorganisms adapt to. And we there's a limit. If they were there, then we wouldn't know what the upper limit was. Now we kind of know at least one upper limit of
that's fascinating. Earth-like. So yeah, so if we find a planet that exists like that, it probably wouldn't have Earth-like life.
Not Earth-like
not the
life.
Best
right. Right.
But who knows what kind of silicon-based life might.
And we wouldn't want to live there.
Right.
All right, Bob, tell us about
super
hydrophobic metals.
Super hydrophobicity was in the news this past week or so. So scientists inspired by nature have engineered a metal that can float. And this metal will float even if it's punctured with holes.
You mean like a boat?
Like what?
Like a boat.
We shall see. So this is from researchers at the University of Rochester and the Chang Chun Institute of Optics, Fine Mechanics, and Physics in China. Superhydrophobicity, that's my favorite 19-letter word. So I'll start with that. It's a fun word. It's a characteristic. It's an attribute of materials in nature or engineered that are completely averse to water. You can kind of figure that out from the word, right? Super hydrophobicity, phobia, water. The way that this actually works is that the surface is the patterns are so complicated at the nanoscale and microscale that water, for some reason, which I haven't figured out yet, air just hugs that surface, and therefore, when any water tries to get on it, it just bounces right off. So in nature, everyone has heard of a lotus leaf. Lotus leaf, you pour water on, it just rolls right off. It does not really interact with the surface.
So there's a thin layer of air covering it?
Exactly.
And you can't wipe the air away?
It's like trash.
No, you blow it away, Jay, and it just kind of comes right back in. So scientists, or these scientists, have been thinking, well, can we make metal float using superhydrophobicity? So they look to nature to figure out, all right, and it's always good to look at nature because it's been doing hundreds of millions of years of R&D. So they've got a lot of stuff figured out. So they look at this is a diving bell spiders and fire ants. So diving bell spiders have superhydrophobic abdomens and legs, so they can trap air. Air gets trapped there. So they basically weave a web somehow underwater. They've got a bell-shaped web underwater. They probably weave it on the surface and then bring it down, maybe. I'm not sure. But so they go down and they take the water from their hairs and put it in their
air,
web.
The air.
What did
you
I say?
You said water.
Okay, I meant
everyone
air.
Know what you meant.
Yes. So imagine taking a ball of air, just like here's... I think, just breathing, having air that you can just kind of manipulate and put someplace.
It's called a balloon.
But yes. Just a bubble of air.
Could you take a balloon and just shove it in your mouth, Jay?
Yeah.
All right. That's right. He did do that when he was a kid. So they can stay underwater for quite a bit of time. Fire ants, you've seen mats of fire ants on water. They're just like a floating on water.
Oh, yeah.
So they've got super hydrophobic bodies. So so the bottom layer has air. They have air under their body. And then the other ants just pile on. And I wouldn't want to be on the bottom of that.
Right?
And that's how they float. So taking that inspiration, they decided, well, let's take some metal and we'll have to etch these microfine patterns on. So what are you going to etch it with? A laser, of course. But in this case, it's a femtosecond laser. That's 10 to the minus 15 seconds, a quadrillionth of a second, very fast, very powerful. And when they did that, when they etched these patterns on it, it actually floated. These little discs of metal floated.
What
really
kind of metal?
It actually works on different metals, but I think the tests were initially done on aluminum.
Aluminium.
So the problem was though that after a while the surfaces wore away because there was some interaction, so it wore away. So they had to figure out, how could we do it without? Now the easy way to do it is to have an enclosed surface, right? Just a hollow metal. That's not what they're going for. They want to make it float because it's super hydrophobic. So they took two discs. Now imagine we got two discs. I'll use these coins that happen to be. These are SG coins that you can get on back there if you're interested. So imagine you've got these two coins, and we etch this side and we etch this side, and then we put the two etched sides together. It's kind of like what shape?
A sandwich.
A Cylon base. Remember that shape?
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly like that. So you got the
old school Cylon.
Oh, even the new school ones.
Yeah, they copied that same.
It's basically two disc shapes connected in the middle. So they had to find out exactly what the distance was, but that once you got the right distance, and if this is super hydrophobic and this is, you basically have, it would be filled with air, and water would not go in there because it was at the exact distance. And these discs, when they put them in water, and they would hold them down for 2 months, and then they would just still pop right to the surface.
But how much air, the thing that I don't understand is the weight of the metal seems to be more than the amount of air that gets trapped. Meaning the amount of buoyancy that you would get from that layer of air, how does that work?
Yeah, these weren't steel slabs, Jay. These were thin discs of metal.
Oh,
right. These were not huge, heavy chunks of metal.
So what would be an obvious application if it has to be like just thin sheets of metal?
Well, I mean, but the thing is, though, you could take lots of thin sheets of metal and put them together, right? And then and from there you could go, well, they've talked about potentially making some types of unsinkable boats. But remember, because it's relying on the super hydrophobicity, it's actually, they punctured it. They punctured it like a disc. Imagine taking this disc and putting six holes in it, and it still floated because you're not impacting the water aversion at all. So that's the major benefit. So you can make a boat potentially out of this. They're talking about flotation vests.
But doesn't it have to be really thin and lightweight?
But you have multiple layers, you're saying.
So you're gonna then you're adding a bunch more.
Yeah, right. Imagine a billion of these. I mean, get a million of these and make a boat out of it. But not just a boat, but also you could do like a flotation vest that if it's punctured or damaged, all the air is not going to come out, right? Because of the surface. Or you could have underwater monitoring electronics. And if you coat the surface, then water can't get to that surface. And these electronic monitors can survive for really long, or maybe indefinitely. Cool. So commercial viability, of course, is a little bit of a problem because they've got to scale this up. And to do that, they said they need a faster laser. So maybe they'll develop an attosecond laser designed just for this process.
Hey, Bob.
Yes.
Be honest. You have a Google alert set up for the word femtosecond, don't you? That's why you picked this article.
Yeah, and attosecond.
They'll read that, but not your emails.
All right.
You don't want to know my other keywords.
So, Evan, I hear there are giant alien bugs on Mars.
Well, according to an entomologist, yes, absolutely there are. In fact, Professor Emeritus William Romeser, entomologist from Ohio University, says that there's evidence of fossilized and living creatures on Mars. Perhaps you have all heard about this particular news item, as it were. I mean, how can you argue with that? You're seeing it with you're seeing it with your own eyes. Here's a quote. The insect-like fauna observed appeared to be sheltering/nesting in caves, in burrows beneath the surface, and in specialized structures. This is from a paper that that actually got
is
that
it,
they
is
published.
It in, is it in the Pareidolia Times?
Yeah, right. No kidding. I mean, talk. At what point do some of these people who work at universities get to the very basics of skepticism? It's like they skip that entirely, as if there's as if there aren't groups of skeptic organizations and things out there like teaching this basic 101 idea of pareidolia.
That's why I've often said that's why we need to exist, right? Because it isn't baked into academia.
No.
It really isn't. You can have technical knowledge, very sophisticated knowledge in an area, but have huge gaps in some basic critical thinking skills or just knowledge of pseudoscience as well. And like pareidolia is something that most people, even academicians, don't know about.
Academicians.
And the entire university apparently itself wasn't aware of it because they allowed this to get published.
Well, and that goes to show, I think, also how siloed academia still is. The fact that this entomologist did not feel the need to consult any like
NASA?
Astrobiologists or just any physicist, anybody who actually would have knowledge of whether or not this was possible.
He's been teaching for 45 years. I mean, is this considered part of like ivory tower syndrome in a way?
But you would think that, you know, even like a person that isn't extraordinarily familiar with critical thinking like we are, which, you know, did not one red flag go up for any of the people that saw this, like at any point during the chain of command?
Is it peer reviewed or is this like in the archive? Do we know?
I don't think it was peer-reviewed. Yeah, it was just something that they put
out
themselves.
You would think the reviewers would be like, well, I don't know about this.
But how about the common sense where's the oxygen on Mars for anything like this living to have existed? This thing would have had to have been, what, billions of years old?
And why would it have an
maybe
Earth
if there was
configuration,
oxygen,
like an Earth insect configuration of anatomical parts?
I mean, you got to put it in the category. What else have we seen on Mars? We've seen iguanas. We've seen rats. We've seen Bigfoot. We've
pyramids.
Seen trees.
Pyramids.
We've,
the face.
The face.
Tube
the pyramid.
Things, right? Like the little lava tube.
Yeah.
No, but like the little, like people say that there were streets, like whole infrastructures on Mars.
So NASA did, you know, have some, when NASA was asked about it, you know, they were, you know, obviously had to say that, look, the collective general opinion of the large majority of the scientific community is that current conditions on the surface of Mars are not suitable for liquid water or complex life. Okay, as if you really needed to go to NASA to get that. Now, the most recent news, I don't know if you saw this in the last 24 hours, is that the university has taken the paper down, scrubbed all links to it, and put out basically a one-sentence statement saying that...
Oops.
the professor is not available for comment, and we have no further comment on this at all. They scrubbed it.
Yeah.
They scrubbed it just in the last 24 hours. Because I went looking for the original link last night and gone.
I wonder if it's in, like, the Wayback Machine. Or
it's been captured. You can still find it, but it's no longer something that they're promoting directly on their webpages.
They must be so embarrassed. I mean, that's a major fail in quality control.
Major fail.
It's a major fail.
This is Kara. So
that's not me.
No, that's not Kara. This item, Kara's going to tell us how crazy politics can get in the U.S.
You guys.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's too early. I haven't had enough coffee for this yet. So. Okay. I'm going to talk about abortion, but I'm not here to argue pro-life, pro-choice. I'm not here to talk about a position that anybody in the audience or any of us might have. What I am going to talk about is what happens when people who have zero scientific knowledge start legislating Bananarama grams.
But not just also, not just zero scientific knowledge apparently, but no like science consultations, right?
Yeah, like
you
it's
can't
like
know
a,
everything.
Anti-science. Yeah, it's,
it's anti-science.
It's
like they're going against the consultation that's being foisted upon them.
Yes.
Yeah.
So also in Ohio, there is a House Bill 413, which is sponsored by two lawmakers, but also co-sponsored by 19 of the 99-person assembly. So that doesn't mean that only 19 support it. It means that 19 actually were willing to, like, sign and put their name on it and start trying to push this through the House. This is a bill in a state where many of the lawmakers refer to abortion as abortion murder. This is, like, the way they call the practice
procedure,
of abortion, the procedure. Thank you. They are pushing House Bill 413, which proposes that a physician who performs abortion murder on an ectopic pregnancy. Okay, so this is an ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy in which the egg actually implants anywhere outside of the uterus, sometimes in the fallopian tube, sometimes like actually in the ovary. It implants early and it doesn't make it all the way to the uterus.
But can't that kill the mother?
Yes.
In 50% of cases, it will kill the mother if she allows it to continue. It is still the leading cause of mother mortality. Pregnancy mortality in the first trimester in the United States. And overall, I think it's like 4% of all pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. So if you don't catch it and you don't remove it and perform this this procedure, an abortion to remove it, a therapeutic abortion, the only treatment, viable treatment for this, the mom will likely die. I mean, it's a coin flip. It's very, very dangerous. If House Bill 413 makes it to law, the mother and the physician who perform abortion murder on an ectopic pregnancy could be sentenced to up to 15 years in jail if they don't make a reasonable effort to try to implant the egg or the fertilized egg into the uterus. Here's the kicker. This is not a real procedure.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist in medicine. And multiple physicians have petitioned the government to say, like, we can't do this. It's not a thing that any doctors do. It's not a thing we've ever done. You guys aren't inventing a new procedure for us. It can't be done. We don't do it. And so you see all these tweets from these physicians, like, we're all going to jail.
Yeah.
We're all going to jail because, you know, we signed an oath and we have to protect these people. Right. And if we don't perform this therapeutic abortion, these mothers will die. So, it's just one of these,
And this is not the first time they've done this.
No, they've
already
been told.
They tried
to push it through once. Yeah. They also tried to push through this heartbeat bill, which was that would criminalize abortion beyond the time when there's a fetal heartbeat, which is about 6 weeks, which is in violation. Well, it's not in violation of the Constitution, but it's been struck down by the Supreme Court. Roe v. Wade is still being maintained at the federal level.
But critically, that's usually before most women know they're pregnant.
Absolutely.
So when
that's
you find out
point.
You're pregnant, it's already too late.
It's already
which is
too
obviously
late.
The point. Which
yeah.
Is the point.
And so, and so, the, in some ways, the purpose of this type of legislation is a state's rights attempt to push against and try to overturn Roe v. Wade. The hope is that there will be a suit that's brought, and then it'll eventually make it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Right. That's the goal.
Yeah, but the scary thing and the most, I think, blatantly anti-science thing here is the fact that they're pushing for something that doesn't even exist scientifically. So there's a beautiful quote here, and I think this really sums up the story quite well. Kate Gilmore is the United Nations Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights. And she was at a conference, and when asked about House Bill 413, she said, quote, "When the United States starts to sneeze under the force of the pneumonia of a factual, illegal, and ascientific policy, everybody starts to catch the same cold." Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really beautiful quote. So luckily, people around the world are laughing at us. Unfortunately, I worry that that kind of pressure doesn't really make it through. That's what I said. They are.
Well, let me broaden this just a bit, though, because you know, medical ethics is a pretty well-developed field.
Yeah,
you know, physicians, you know, have a pretty elaborate set of guidelines in terms of how we treat patients and, you know, what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. Whenever legislation tries to meddle in, you know, the relationship between a physician and a patient, it's always bad. It's never like improving that relationship or the ethics of medical practice, because it's a very much a moving target, right? Where legislation is too slow to really track it, and it's very it's based on principles. And so you write into law things, and this, you know, I've spoken about laws that are passed in Connecticut or in my region, and even sometimes insurance companies, they try to get too micromanaging in terms of like what we do. It's like, you know, I had to have a meeting with an insurance company a couple of years ago to explain to them that your current policy is forcing me to do something that's unethical.
Yeah.
I cannot do that.
What is
it's unethical.
What is the AMA? So the APA, the American Psychological Association, has certain like guidelines about what happens when the law pushes up against psychological ethics. What is the AMA?
It's the same thing. We have our first duty is to the patient, not
exactly.
to the state, not to the insurance company.
And it's like you should be willing to have
patient.
To go to court.
Absolutely.
To have to go to jail,
you go down for your patient.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like these doctors will save a woman's life by doing, you know, removing an ectopic pregnancy and just face the consequences. They have no choice.
Which could be up to 15 years in prison for the doctor and the mother.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
But I'm confused about this because at that point, isn't it considered an abortion?
Yeah.
So it's only in states. It's only in states where they where abortion is legal.
This is only in Ohio.
It's just in Ohio.
Abortion is illegal in the first trimester in all 50 states.
Right.
Yeah. And so Ohio, though, has been the state that's sort of leading the cause to push the most restrictive abortion laws. So
successful.
They're the ones who push this heartbeat law, which actually did fail, but they're going to keep trying.
Yeah.
So that's
at
6 weeks is when they want to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jay.
Yes.
So. Everyone's heard that phrase, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right?
It was or that song.
First written by Kelly Clarkson, right? You guys remember that. That's what the internet told me.
Kelly Clarkson?
Everything on the internet's true, you guys.
She didn't write that.
She did write it later.
Well, she stole it from...
Yeah. But did she think that she was the first person to say that?
No, but that's the meme.
It's
okay.
A joke.
Well, but is it true?
Jokes are best when you have to explain.
Is what it sounds good. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It sounds good, but is it actually true?
Well, that's a complicated question.
I figured.
So the first person that we think said that was, and I can't, you know, come on, it's a hard name to pronounce correctly, but Friedrich Nietzsche?
Friedrich.
How would you guys pronounce this name, Friedrich Nietzsche?
Nietzsche.
Thank you. All right, so we think that he said it.
It does make
sense because of the types of studying and what he did basically. It follows his philosophy. Now this is what people say enduring a form of tragedy or having to deal with a major life event could be good for personal growth, and this is what people have to say about that. The benefits are claimed to give you a reinvigorated appreciation for life. You will appreciate your friends and family more. You'll learn from the experience and you'll become more resilient.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is, summed up for you. And we hear this sentiment from, it's in the media, it's on, it's in pop culture like crazy, it's, TV shows and everything.
And it does, I have to say, this could be all confirmation bias, but it does seem to fit life experience, at least within like a normal range of what people go through. And the other end of the spectrum is if someone's pampered and protected from any adversity, they're lacking something, right?
They're weak. They won't develop coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like an adult that's not an adult.
Yeah, exactly. They were never forged, by adversity.
But I think they're talking here about extreme traumatic events.
Yeah.
Okay, so what does the science have to say about it? So psychologists have really only been directly researching this for about a decade. And the psychologists Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun, they have documented people saying after a traumatic experience that they feel that they have a greater appreciation for life, that their relationships are stronger, and they feel more spiritual and more inspired. And the researchers are calling this post-traumatic growth. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's true at this point is yet to fully be determined, but that's what they call the claim, mm-hmm. right? So, and again, this all sounds great, right? Why? Because, even in the face of a horrible tragedy, we can comfort people by saying this, hey, you're going to, on the other end of this thing, and I've said this to people, because, when you're in that position where you're trying to make somebody feel better, what can you say other than, yeah, that really sucks?
You're cooked.
You want to say things like, hey, listen, once you get through this, you're gonna be better on the other side or whatever. There's different things that we do say, but this is kind of cooked into it. So there's issues with believing this, though. So let's unpack this. So the most interesting one is that a problem that we have with just believing is that we really can't study people before they've gone through a traumatic event, because of how typically unpredictable that they are.
You'd have to baseline a lot of people and then follow them over time.
And that's money and time. That's the problem.
Or just study somebody and then traumatize them,
Science. That's very ethical.
You would just do a between group study instead of a within. You wouldn't look at the same person twice. You would look at a group of people who didn't experience trauma and compare them to a group of people who did experience trauma.
Yeah. You don't have a baseline.
You don't. Yeah. You just have to assume that those things come out in the wash, which is hard with people.
Yeah. So what they do to study this, though, is they take the bulk of the existing research on post-traumatic growth, ask people that have gone through a traumatic experience to estimate what they were like before the traumatic experience.
That's problematic.
So there's problems with doing this because people don't accurately remember what they were like before the event. And we're talking about it could be a week, even a week later. They just don't have, they're not in that frame of mind anymore, so they can't accurately communicate what it was like to be them before the event. People will also claim to have grown from the event, but they're actually still suffering, which, to put it in a very severe way, they're lying to the people that ask the question and probably to themselves that they're doing better, but they're actually not doing better.
But there's also you've got to operationally define so many things there, because you could have grown and also still be suffering. Those things can exist at the same time.
Right.
So it's just, the construct itself is difficult to study.
Right, because the whole thing is just, it's all subjective.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the problem.
Yeah, there's got to be an interaction between, again, the person's baseline, their resilience going into the trauma and how extreme the trauma is. And what I would suspect is that for certain, severity or, mismatch of trauma to resilience, people do come out the other end better. But it's like the bend versus break thing.
Mm-hmm.
Most people will bend and then bounce back, but if you go too far for that person, they break, and then they're worse at the other end.
Exactly. That is different for everybody.
Yeah. That's what
So the final thing that they said was that people who did report that they are, quote unquote, better than they were before the traumatic experience, their friends and family are saying, no, they're not. So Western culture has also created this really sad expectation that we're supposed to get over everything. Yeah. It's almost like
suck it up.
A sitcom TV show where something horrible happens, and then hey, next time you see your friend, they're supposed to be back in form. Human psyche just doesn't work like that. And I'll admit on a personal level, I've been losing dad as an example. We lost our father 2.5 years ago. I'm still tremendously suffering from the finality of that and the fact that there's so many things that I lost that I'm still unpacking the effect, right? Mm-hmm. But, when the average person asks me how I'm doing, I lie. I'm like, I'm fine. Everything's fine, because I just don't want to even talk about it. I'm being avoidant and I'm also just not wanting to, I don't want them to feel bad for me.
Right.
There's all these social things that come into play when we're dealing with other people.
And it is very cultural.
Yeah.
It's absolutely very
cultural. And it's also, I think the question really comes down to what it is you're talking about when you talk about resilience and what it is you're talking about when you actually use this quote, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Does it mean that it makes me not have a reaction to trauma? No, I think that we know, we have literature established that traumatic events affect people very negatively, incredibly negatively. But are you now better prepared for the time when you lose your mother because you lost your father and you develop those skills throughout that thing?
Yeah.
In that way, maybe you are developing resiliency even though you are suffering from the trauma. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so under the best circumstances, I think the way to look at it would be that you become more mature Mm-hmm. Right? It's not like I can handle, you know, like, you know, it's like getting hit on the head with a 2x4 and over time I'm going to be able to take it without any pain. It's totally different than that. It's more of like you're just becoming more mature and more understanding.
And also we're talking about somebody who is an adult who has a lot of means, who has a lot of, who has a high intellect, all of these things. But once you start talking about traumatic events with very young children, traumatic events with people with cognitive deficit, I mean, it's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, but you know the number one predictor of resilience to trauma is a support structure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what the study says.
Yeah. Support structure is everything. So that even goes beyond the individual.
That's the number one predictor of improvement in therapeutic. It's like how much are you dedicated to the therapy and how much you have people around you.
And just in medical disease.
Yeah.
I'm not done. I have to actually say what the science found out. So the best studies out there that examine post-traumatic growth have found that an individual's perception of their own growth doesn't track with their actual change over time.
Sure.
And ironically, the people who claimed to have the most growth were the ones who were actually suffering the most.
Really?
So the researchers say that we don't know for sure how if there is legitimate growth after a trauma, but here's what the best science so far says. They say that people can indeed grow from adversity, exactly like what Kara said. They can become stronger, they can improve the quality of their relationships, and they can increase their self-esteem, but it probably doesn't happen as nearly as often as society pretends that it does, or as often as society would like to think that it does. And not everyone will grow in the same way and at the same speed, which is what we just said.
Yeah.
And people will continue to need help and social support, which is another thing. You know, you should have just written this article. We need our friends in the communities in the wake of a traumatic event, and it's not in the short term. We need them to be there, you know. Because, I mean, again, on a personal note, 2.5 years after I lost my dad, I need to talk about it. Yeah. I need to commiserate with you guys.
Yeah. We still talk about Perry. Yeah. The loss of Perry still affects us to this day. It definitely affects me.
And it's interesting how differently we reacted to it, right? Mm-hmm. How we deal with it. Each of us, like Jay and I, are like almost on other ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, Bob compartmentalizes and avoids, and I have to face it full on and wear it until I overcome it.
Yeah, it's like, why are you doing that to yourself?
I think that sometimes what we do, because we're so used to this like medical model and we want observable evidence that's like somehow outside of the human being. We don't want this like subjective evidence. But the truth of the matter is self-report is a form of evidence. And just because somebody said, like you were saying, what they found in the study is them saying that they feel better doesn't comport with what? With other people saying that? How is somebody else's report about them somehow more valid or valuable than their own report about themselves? And so I do think that, yes, there are, you know, key indicators. This person seems to be struggling in life. We have more conflict in the home, blah, blah, blah. But how they see themselves, for all intents and purposes, is probably the most important piece of data when it comes to a therapeutic recovery after a traumatic event. So I think that to kind of discount or minimize that as part of the equation is maybe not looking at this from the most appropriate angle.
Well, you know what they said? They said that they believe that people will say that they're doing better because it's self-therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they're talking
Which
to...
Which is fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the truth is, a psychologist or a counselor working on resiliency with a post-trauma client, whether or not there's some sort of achievable goal, blah, 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 it is therapeutic. And so whether or not they actually are going to, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to be able to answer that question fully.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, there is, I think, a positive benefit from having those kinds of conversations, or from believing this yourself.
Right.
It's probably the only way some people are going to get through trauma.
And one last thought, they said that they think that society should not have this pressure for everything to be okay, especially in the short term. And that in a lot of cases, if people just got back to where they kind of were before the trauma, that would be totally acceptable.
Mm. So just to wrap this up a little bit, so in medicine, you know, we talk about patients having a narrative of their own illness, right? Mm. And so part of like my job is to try to understand what's the patient's narrative about their own illness, and then how can I alter that narrative in a more constructive way, right? They may have like misinformation or pseudoscience, or they're assuming causes and effects that are not there or whatever. And part of that is to make the narrative therapeutic, like and focusing on, let's not worry about the stuff we can't do anything about. Let's focus on the stuff we can do stuff about, on the good probabilities, you know. Like you don't say you have a 90% chance of dying. You say you have a 10% chance of living, you know. It's the same information, but it's just, you know, affecting the narrative in an optimal
way.
Especially
if that
really
fits their narrative. Yeah.
Wouldn't you call that spin?
Well, we've called it framing.
Framing?
We call it framing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who here has heard about climate tipping points? Right? It's actually a difficult concept that scientifically our understanding of it is still evolving. And then I think a lot of people, though, misunderstand exactly what we're talking about when we talk about tipping points. How many have heard that we have 12 years to fix the climate change problem? And of course, we hear that quoted as sort of a criticism, like mm-hmm. the climate change denialists. Like, they say that the world's going to end in 12 years. Like, nope, that's not what anyone is saying. That's not what it's about. It derives from a couple of things. So about 20 years ago was when the concept of climate tipping points was introduced scientifically. And they said, you know, it's not just a linear effect that we're seeing where you have more CO2, you have an increasing temperature. There are feedback loops in the environment, and some of those feedback loops may be positive, meaning that it doesn't dampen down the effect, it actually amplifies it. So one of those effects is as North Pole ice melts, less light is being reflected back into space, and so the albedo goes down, so the oceans will absorb more heat, and therefore will trap more heat. Another one is, this is interesting, when the Greenland ice sheet melts, it actually loses altitude, right? It's melting down, mm-hmm. and the air, therefore, is getting warmer.
So you get these runaway effects.
The more it melts, the warmer the air next to the ice gets, therefore, the faster it melts. And that will just keep happening until the whole thing melts. The question was, when will these tipping points, and there's over a dozen of them, when will they get triggered? Now, 20 years ago, when they first really started looking at this, the thought was, the evidence and the models suggested that we would need to get to about 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures before these tipping points would occur. Now, 20 years later, they're saying, it's not 5°C, it's more like 2°C, yeah, 2
that's
degrees
what I
Celsius.
Have heard.
That's a huge
so that's, that was that's ba- like the Paris difference. Agreement was yeah. based upon that.
Right.
And now a new paper was published in Nature that's saying, actually, it's probably 1.5°C.
So are we already there?
We're already there.
So that's it.
So they're basically saying for many, they said 9 specific tipping points, we're actually already there.
Cool.
But there's another way to look at this, and that is what's our carbon budget, right? So how much more carbon could be released into the atmosphere before we get to, and again, it's not all or nothing. There are different tipping points at different points in time, and how fast they will unfold depends on how much warming there is. So they said, if we want to keep to 2°C, which is still going to put us past some tipping points, we have a carbon budget of 500 gigatons of carbon. We're releasing about 40 gigatons a year. So you figure that's 12 years, right? That's where the 12 years comes from. It's not like in 12 years everyone's going to die.
But that's also, based on current levels?
That's based on current levels.
Those won't be maintained.
Nope.
Well, assuming we maintain current levels, we've got about 12 years of carbon budget before we're past even the now conservative tipping points. Mm. However, it's worse than that because If you then include the carbon and methane released from glaciers that are melting, that's 100 gigatons of carbon right there.
Oop, there you go. We've already, 20% more.
Yeah, we've already eaten up 20% there. And if you include burning the rainforest, that's releasing another 90 gigatons of carbon.
Another 20%.
And so we probably have eaten most of our way into that 500 gigaton.
By these runaway effects,
that's right. So that's why then they're talking about not only is there a tipping point or different tipping points, there's a domino effect of tipping points.
Sure.
Where one tipping point gets you from 1.5 to 2°C, and then that triggers another one, which gets you to 3°C, which triggers another one. And so yet another way to think about this is equilibrium, right? So we are starting with our pre-industrial ecosystem climate in an equilibrium that is not that stable on long term, right? We're in an interglacial period of an ice age, essentially.
But that's like tens of thousands
of
years.
So over tens of thousands of years, we're not in, our equilibrium is actually, we're in an unstable period, this ice age. But we can get into another glacial period, but that's over tens of thousands of years.
We're talking about ones of years.
Yeah, no, well, it's actually longer than most people think. But so,
really?
Yeah, in terms of until we reach a new equilibrium point, right? So
oh,
the question
I see,
is, if we stopped releasing CO2 now, when are we going to reach our new equilibrium point, and what is that new equilibrium point going to be? That's what they're trying to figure out.
But, sorry, is that even a valid question? Because that's unrealistic.
What's unrealistic?
We are not going to stop.
Well, that's just a thought experiment. Okay. So that's our baseline. If we stopped releasing CO2 now, what are we already committed to? If we magically waved a wand and got rid of all CO2 production.
Yeah, what's the damage that's already been done that can't be undone?
And so that's sort of like, we're already going to get to 1.5C even if we stop everything now.
Right.
But the Paris Accord is getting us to 2C. And we're not even meeting those goals.
Yeah. We're not even in it anymore in
the U.S. I know, pulled out, unfortunately. But
we're not even trying to meet those goals.
So what does all this mean? So this is
some companies are.
This is the recent Nature paper. Okay, here's where we are. So first of all, the 5C, nope, it's more like 2, and then for some tipping points, 1.5. We're actually already there for some. And the other way to look at the tipping points is it's like going over a cliff. Like once you're over the cliff, you're falling to the bottom. There's no way to stop that. So what are the things that we're already committed to? One is they believe, again, this is, we don't know for sure, but our models predict that the collapse of the Antarctic ice sheet, the Western ice sheet, and probably the Eastern is already a done deal, right? It's going to happen. Once you get a certain, it has to do with the ice and the land and the ocean. Where do they meet? And then once it retreats to a certain point, you're going to get a runaway effect.
And then you said that's also in and of itself going to release 100.
No, that's different.
Oh, okay.
That's more like the Arctic melting.
The Arctic, 100 okay.
This is the Antarctic. Gotcha. What that's going to do, if the Western ice sheet completely collapses, that will raise the oceans by 3 meters.
How long before the collapse?
It depends. How long before the collapse, we don't know, but it depends on how much warming we have. It'll be between 1,000 and 10,000 years before it plays itself out completely.
Before the full sea level rise.
Okay. Right. So 1,000 is if we are keep going the way we're going.
Right.
It'll be about 1,000 years, maybe less. If we put the brakes on maximally, we could put it off for 10,000 years.
And would that have not happened anyway in like 10 or 20 or 30?
No.
It wouldn't.
Okay. No, it wouldn't have happened in the short term. The ice that's there is millions of years old.
Yeah, gotcha.
So the other thing is about the tipping points is these are irreversible on human timescales. So if the Antarctic ice sheet collapses in 1,000 years, we're never going to replace that.
Because it took a million years.
It'll take
years
millions of years
there.
To lay that ice down.
I wasn't sure how long these ice ages were.
Yeah, but the Antarctic is not the ice age. That's permanent.
Right. It's always been there.
Perma-ice, right?
So then all sorts of other horrible stuff is going to happen when that melts,
Well, then if the Eastern ice sheet collapses in Antarctica, that's another 3 meters. So now we're up to 6 meters. If the Greenland ice sheet collapses, that's another 4 or 5 meters. So now we're talking 10, 12 meters of water rise.
So say goodbye to every coastal city.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, a new map will you'll see.
And not to mention how much warmer things would get just with all of the greenhouse gases released from everything that's trapped.
Then you get more fires, which turns carbon sinks into carbon release sources, and you release methane from the permafrost.
Wow.
And they're all connected, so that's where you get the domino effect where one thing happens to another.
Steve, those collapses, are they a singular event, or is it could be little mini collapses, one day it's going to... One of them's going to collapse?
No, it's over 1,000
Over thousands of years.
Okay.
It just means...
Imagine that wave.
It's
that
unstoppable. It's unstoppable.
But it's kind of like what we already start to see in the Arctic, right? Where every time there's a major event where there's something calves off and we see, and then it's covered in the new... These are the little things that are adding up to become that big thing.
So we're finally at the point now where we need science fiction. If we're going to start thinking about science fiction...
There's no extrapolation of current technology that will fix this.
We're at mitigation point.
So their point is, the authors of this paper, saying, all right, here's where we are. We're already committed to certain tipping points. It's only a matter of how fast and how many, and we're not really sure where it's going to end because you may get this cascading effect. And it may be in 10,000 years, even in the best case scenario, we're committed to 10 meters of ocean sea level rise. Not 12 years. We're still talking thousands of years. But the point is we're committed. Like, you can't stop it anymore. And we're falling off that cliff. It's just going to take 1,000 years to hit the bottom, but we're going to hit it. But they say, but the difference between 1,000 years and 10,000 years, or and it could be less
maybe
than 1,000 years,
if we mitigate.
But the difference is, how much time will we have to retool our civilization, right? Because we have to move billions of people. And because we have lots of coastal cities, we've built most of our cities on the coast.
Guys, we're still living on a globe where prominent leaders who have the
power to establish legislation in countries with hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of people, don't believe in climate change. So, like, how do we mobilize these people? Like,
I know.
How do we even pass legislation?
Their conclusion was that based upon their models, this is basically an emergency in that if we don't do extreme things now, we're committed to pretty much the worst case scenario in terms of the tipping points.
And the thing is, we're not going to do extreme
things now.
We're not
going to do
it.
No, we're cooked. There's no way we're going to have the political will to do what we would need to do. We're not going to. I think we're pretty much committed to 2C. I don't think anyone thinks realistically we're going to keep things to 1.5.
Okay, but what if we did dramatic changes 20 years ago? Would that really have made much of a difference?
Yes.
Yeah.
20 years?
Yes. Because this is an exponential problem.
I know,
if we really took serious action 20 years ago, does that mean that,
we probably could have kept it 1.5, right?
Right.
And there's a big difference between 1.5 and 1.5.
Or the decay would have taken place over tens of thousands
of years, not just
1,000
years. If we behaved properly a generation ago.
Well, if this is the chart, and you're talking about moving this to here, it's going to be a significant difference on the y-axis.
But the other thing, a couple of takeaways. Here are the takeaways. Right. One is, we really got to get moving now, even though we're not going to, because we don't have the political will. But if we really want
the political will is largely driven by the people.
Yeah.
Why we,
and hopefully papers like this will light a fire.
But the people who really don't believe in climate change are reading these papers.
The other take home is it's a lot worse than we thought. Yeah. Unfortunately, that the tipping points are moving closer and closer and closer, and there's the domino effect interrelated triggering tipping points. But the other thing is, and this is important because I hear this even from people who are environmentalists, it's never too late to do something to keep it from getting even worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So people go, in 10 years it'll be too late. Yeah. In 12 years it's never going to be too late. Because if we don't do something in 10 years or in 20 years or in 50 years, it'll be even worse, you know? So we can always keep it from getting even worse.
I think the issue is that there is a point where when you're consumed by fire, you can't put the fire out actively because you are surrounded on all sides. And I think that it's not that it's never going to be too late to keep it from getting worse. But when it's so late that all we're doing is putting out little fires and we can't look at the big picture,
that's
a problem.
So they call that the global tipping point, right? Not these regional specific tipping points, but we don't really know if there's a global tipping point, but that's the worry. They make the case, this is, even if you think scientifically, like you disagree technically with these models, there's a reasonable case to make for these models, and the downside of not adhering to them is pretty extreme. But we're committing future generations to this. This is not going to affect us, this 3-meter, 10-meter ocean rise. It will affect people, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now.
And that's my fear. That's my fear, because I think people are going to hear, this is going to happen in 1,000 years or 10,000 years, and people are like, let them handle it. That's so far in the future.
No, we love
the ocean
kicking the can
is rising
down the road,
now.
But there will be lesser effects. We're seeing them now. Yeah. And
that's why I think they should focus on, this is what the life of your kids and grandkids is going to be like. Yeah. And when you go start saying 1,000 years, a millennia, they're going to be like, so what?
Well, we need to understand frame it differently. But the truth of the matter is people have a hard time connecting something like a climate refugee to a problem of climate change, like geopolitical issue, to what they think of as this third rail kind of scientific issue when all these things are connected.
Well, it's also a part of society growing up. Like, instead of us only being able to look 20, 30 years into the future, we have to look 1,000 years. We have a response.
Owe it to future generations.
Look at nuclear waste. It's
We operate on a 4-year timescale in our country. We do. Yeah. I mean, that's the political cycle, and that dictates so much. 4 years.
All right.
That's how far we see in the future.
Happy stuff on a Sunday morning, right, folks?
Well, let's talk about puppies.
Puppies.
Yeah.
Wait. Puppies. I thought you said happy. We're going to talk about a dead dog now.
It's the sweetest dead dog ever.
Who saw this news item just the other day? Probably a lot of you. This is Dogor, D-O-G-O-R, found in Siberia. Yes, this is a, they think it's a puppy. It could be a puppy. Perhaps it's a puppy wolf.
Wait. We have to make stuffed animals of Dogor.
Dogor.
Oh, yes.
And we'll make a mint.
How old is this puppy, do you think? 18 DNA analysis? How about 18,000?
18,000
years ago? Yep. died at the tender age of 2 months old. Oh, poor little thing. I love dogs. I so love dogs. Yeah, this is fascinating. This, if this is shown to be an actual dog, it will be the oldest dog. Preserved animal, preserved dog.
And when you say, like, it is an actual animal, just if it's shown to be a dog, not a wolf.
Dog, not a wolf, okay. Right. Yeah, that's really the crux of this. Is it a dog? Is it a wolf? Or is it a what, Jay? Hybrid?
It's a hybrid.
It's a hybrid. It's a hybrid. It wouldn't be a hybrid, technically, just to be clear.
It
would be an evolutionarily transitional, you know.
Is there a breed? Could we say that this is kind of like a breed of any kind?
Well, it would be pre-breeds.
It's pre-breeds?
Yeah, it would be pre-breeds.
Absolutely, yeah.
Look at his whiskers. He still has whiskers.
So they've analyzed it. They say they have a lot to learn from this little puppy.
The thing is, if it was a dog, meaning that this is the result of selective breeding, mm-hmm. this was somebody's dog.
Mm-hmm. Right? Or it was like a village's dog. Or
yeah,
something.
Right. But
yeah.
I mean, it was around. It was living with humans. Humans interacted with it.
Or it was garbage dumping itself, yeah. doing all that kind of
at
stuff.
At this point in time, it may have been not through breeding, but just through like dogs self-evolved, if you will, wolves, right. mm-hmm. by adapting to human civilization, living off of the scraps of human civilization.
Right, on the outskirts of
And, of, you know, the ones that were more docile, you know, less likely to be chased away by the humans were the
they
ones
reproduced.
That
were... They
reproduced.
It might be kind
of like, food.
Like the coyotes that we see in L.A., yeah. like in our neighborhood. So they're yeah. definitely not... You wouldn't want to go up to it because it might still bite you and blah, blah, blah. But they're not as scared when the cars drive by. Yeah. And it's like, it's this... kind of urban adaptation, but that's what that
like
was.
There's jackals somewhere that do that too. Like
oh, in Africa, the jackals yeah. will come into the campsite. Yeah.
The puppy is in Russia. Scientists have taken a rib to Sweden to conduct further genetic testing. They're trying to, again, find out where it sits in the canine evolutionary tree, and it could reveal more information about when dogs and wolves diverge from a common ancestor.
That's so cool.
And when and how dogs were domesticated.
Yeah.
So would this be the oldest dog, like the tangible evidence that we have? If it were a dog?
Yes, of an existing, of a specimen of this.
But even fossils, right? Do we have fossil, like dogs that are this old?
What do we have? We got a 15,000-year-old dog fossil found in Germany.
Yeah, and this is
and
18,
that was considered, right.
This would be
that one was considered, that one's the oldest one up to that point.
How weird that the oldest one would actually be like a perfectly preserved yeah. with yeah. DNA. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah, I mean, the whiskers and everything. There's another picture which we don't have here. They have its mouth open. It has all, you know, all its puppy teeth and everything.
It's shaped just like a little puppy teeth.
How
like
cool would it be if they could like clone it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can see what the dog was like, you know?
Yeah, they could. They could theoretically clone it.
The DNA's in good shape, right?
If that DNA... Yeah, how much has that DNA decayed to that
I think they said they have
point?
43% viability or something.
Is it?
Like
is,
that.
Yeah, 43%.
Like, one of the scientists tweeted about it. Pretty
is
cool.
That, is that enough
Wait,
to
a Jurassic Park joke reintroduce
it? You might have to put it in with, like, dogs or wolves
well,
or some
of course,
modern
yeah.
ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
some
yeah.
other
yeah, Jurassic
material
Park
in there to get it full.
Right.
But
Jurassic, and make sure you put some frog DNA. So
Jurassic dog.
Spontaneously give birth and...
So
neat stuff. These are probably easier to do than a mammoth. Easier
well, it definitely feels more ethical.
What's
than
that?
A mammoth.
How big is it,
He's
guys?
A pup.
30 feet? Is it 30 feet long?
I think he was small, right?
That'd be cool.
2 months old. I don't have the weight or the actual dimensions.
There are
of
some,
it.
If you Google him, you can see him relative to people's arms and hands. So I think he was
pretty small. Yeah, it was like, you know, maybe the size of my forearm. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't tiny like a chihuahua puppy, but like a wolf puppy.
Yeah.
Wolfie.
All right. Yeah, this is the conspiracy.
Oh, it's mine. Okay. So this is a cool one. I'll keep it short and sweet. A paper that was recently published in PLOS ONE, which is the Public Library of Science. It's a great open access journal. These researchers did something called sentiment analysis, which is a technique where they can actually look at real life big data and make some comparisons and draw some conclusions. So they were interested in conspiracy thinkers, and they wanted to try and understand some patterns of behavior among them. So they went to Reddit, and, you know, Reddit has a ton of subreddits, and one of them is r/conspiracy. So, of course, there's some selection bias there, but that's what they were looking at. They wanted to see who is posting on the conspiracy forums within Reddit. How did they get there? What is some of the behavior that led up to it? So they actually took a bunch of users from our conspiracy and they sort of backdated and looked at a bunch of their posts from right before they stumbled into our conspiracy. So they found the point in which they sort of connected to our conspiracy and then they looked at what led up to it. And they compared that to individuals from other channels. So they sort of did match controls that weren't in conspiracy channels. And they wanted to draw some inferences, and they found some really interesting things. They found that conspiracy theorists in many ways really do self-select. They appear to be seeking out communities of people, so once they find that sort of nucleation point, they like to stay there, and they follow really clear pathways. So for example, these users compared to the non-conspiracy users were overrepresented in subreddits focused on politics, drugs, and internet culture, leading up to finding our conspiracy. They also engaged in topics more kind of vehemently. They engaged more often. They posted more. And they said that they were also really surprised by all the different pathways that they took to get there. So you would think that they would all be on one side of the political spectrum. They weren't. They were kind of all over the place. And they didn't find that the people showed measures of like anxiety in their posts. They didn't seem to have more kind of mania or any more indicators that they were more kind of anxious when they posted. And these same researchers have done a bunch of previous research to show that actually conspiracy theorists are not one type of person. They're a lot more diverse than you would think. And they said that actually when they were looking at their previous posts in political subreddits, and then they compared them to other people who posted in those political subreddits but never made their way to our conspiracy, their language was actually pretty similar. Because remember, they're doing sentiment analysis, which is like a linguistic analysis, looking at the use of words and the frequency and things like that. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that they're harder to tease out from the general population, but one of the things that they found was that they do self-select. They don't passively stumble in. They actually build and build and build until they get there. And then, of course, once they're in an echo chamber, it worsens the problem. And I do always like to read a good quote, but here's a great quote from a psychologist named David Funder. He said, quote, "Individuals do not just passively find themselves in the situations of their lives. They often actively seek and choose them." Often is an important word there. But thus, while a certain kind of bar may tend to generate a situation that creates fights around closing time, only a certain kind of person will choose to go to that bar in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good kind of parallel there. Yeah.
Yeah, but just to emphasize one point, though, that these are conspiracy theorists. And not people who believe in a conspiracy. Because
no, these are people who go to a conspiracy subreddit where all sorts of conspiracies are talked about, and they actively engage in
that. Because the research shows that there's basically two overall flavors of people who believe in conspiracies. There are people who believe in specific conspiracies because they are resonant with their ideology. Mm-hmm.
Right. They found a collection of people with whom they agree, and they're able to...
Or like you believe that 9/11 was an inside job because you're a Democrat and you hate George Bush, right? Yeah. Or, you know, you, for example... You believe in that one conspiracy because it does something for you politically. Then there's the all-purpose conspiracy theorists who believe every conspiracy, and the believing in the conspiracy is the point.
But
not, the details don't really matter.
That there is some evidence to show that people who believe in a single conspiracy are then going to be more likely to start taking in other
conspiracies.
Sometimes
that's a gateway. There's a gateway conspiracy.
Interesting. Conditioned sort of to start thinking about things in that lens.
I think people do stumble upon the gateway conspiracy, but if you're already a conspiracy theorist, you are seeking it out.
I think at a certain point, you put on the blinders, and you just become self-selecting.
And they are among us. They're out there spreading the population. It's not like... Yes. They exist everywhere.
So, we're about ready to do science or fiction, and this picture relates to the theme.
It's time for science or fiction.
So every week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. But on this episode, I have four items. And I have a theme. When we were traveling to Milford Sound, our tour guide told us that we were coming up to a stop. And at this stop, we have shamels. Are you ever here for a shamel? No, because they don't exist. Right? It's a sheep and a camel hybrid. Right, Jay? And he was talking about the llamas, which kind of they're woolly camel-like things, you know. So I could see where he said that. Of course, you can't actually, you know, hybridize a sheep and a camel; they're too evolutionarily distant. But that inspired me to do a hybrid themed.
Oh, right.
Nice.
Right?
Yes.
Got it. All right. I'm gonna have to turn around so I can read them. So here are three of these hybrids exist. And three of the statements I'm making about hybrids are true, and one is fiction. So here we are. Number one, a geep is a very rare successful offspring between a goat and a sheep. A geep. A turkey is a hybrid chicken turkey that is easy to raise and especially tasty, but not commercially viable because it is sterile. So you can't breed them, you know. A wolfin, the offspring of a female bottlenose dolphin and a male false killer whale, occur in nature and are fertile. So they can produce a stable population if they were so inclined.
If they were so inclined.
Although dromedary camels weigh up to 6 times as much as llamas, hybrid comma have been successfully produced. Okay, so 3 of those are real, and 1 I made up. Evan, why don't we start with you?
Did you want to poll the audience?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
I do.
Because I need someone to blame.
So we're going to do the single clap method. I'm going to bring my hand when I get to here. You're going to clap if you think it's the fiction, right? So if you think that the geep is fiction, clap.
We should have done a
yes,
practice. Oh, well, that was the practice.
No, that was
all
it.
Right.
If you think that the turkey is the fiction, clap.
One clap.
That was a little
a
weird.
Bad clap.
That was
just
weird.
One clap.
It was a wave of clap.
If you think the wolfin is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the comma is the fiction, clap. So I think 2 and 3 are tied.
Yeah.
Maybe wolfin had the edge.
Yeah.
Wolfin had
almost
the edge.
Nobody for the geep and a few for the comma. Okay. So with that, Evan, what are your thoughts?
No help whatsoever. Thank you. Boy, you know, this is just, you take a guess. You flip 2 coins, right, Bob? And you figure out which one this is. So a geep, you know, it's just such a silly name. For that, you know, that could be a made-up, that absolutely could be a made-up name. The turkey, now the turducken, that's a thing. Okay, so if you'd gone there, I wish you had gone there.
Turducken?
Turducken. Yeah, I could see them trying to have made those. Easy to raise, but not commercially viable. I think I can see that one as being science. The wolfin, you know, I kind of thought that one was science too until the audience maybe convinced me otherwise. I don't know what your guys' collective thought is on that. I'll have to check your Reddit out to see what you're thinking about that one. And then the one about the camels, comma, C-A-M-A, have been successfully produced. Never heard of any of these. Well, I think what I'll do is I'm going to trust my new friends and some of my old friends here in New Zealand. I'm going to say that the wolfin is going to be the fiction. I'm going solely on your recommendation.
All right, Kara.
So I'm going to counter that. I think the wolfin might actually be science. They're both cetaceans, bottlenose dolphins. And this doesn't say the orca. It says the false killer whale, which may actually be a dolphin. So I'm assuming that there's a chance.
I'll just tell you it's a whale.
Yeah, but dolphins are whales.
Yeah, you're right.
So,
but it's not a dolphin.
It's not the same species. But also, we're broadening the species definition out because we don't know.
But they are all cetaceans.
Yeah. Right. So the thing that is the kicker there is that it's fertile. But I think we know that wolves and dogs can breed and they can make fertile offspring. So it's getting wiggly. What's a species? You're also saying, are you saying that the goat, sheep, geep is, it's a successful offspring. Does that mean they're also fertile?
No,
they're alive.
Viable.
Viable, yeah. Okay. So the only one with fertile offspring here is this one. So I think that's kind of the supposed to be the gotcha, which is why I'm going to say that one is science. I think there's probably a turkey. I don't know. It seems like it's one of the easiest things to try to produce because farmers are already able to do some selective breeding there. It's going to be an easier experiment to do. Geep? I don't know. The goat and the sheep feel like they're nowhere near the same species. Like, those feel like 2 very different types of species to me, but I wish I knew what their order, like, you know, their...
That would be helpful.
Yeah, that would be really helpful. And then camels and llamas might be one of those things where even though they're like in other parts of the world and stuff, they actually do have a pretty common ancestor. Maybe you could breed them. So I'm going to go with the geep being, I don't know. I'm using some mental gymnastics, but I'm going to say the geep is the fiction.
All right, Jay.
All right, well, as far as the geep goes, I mean, if you look at goats, they're clearly evil, and sheep are clearly, like, you know, angelic.
What?
And evil.
All right.
Evil preys on the weak and the innocent. And yes, this is the order of things if you believe
Kara,
in religion.
Kara, you used your mental gymnastics. Let Jay use his.
He's shitting on goats. It makes me sad.
They
look evil, so therefore they're
evil.
Those
horizontal slits are awesome.
The turkey is, if it doesn't goddamn exist, they better make it because it sounds like a culinary dream. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to be too sophomoric here, but like they're both boys, I could see it happening. I could see, you know, the hey, how you doing? I'm good. I'm a chicken. I'm a turkey. Let's.
That's how it happens.
Yeah.
You know? That's pretty much how they do it. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That chicken's got game.
Yeah.
Whoa, that was good. Yeah.
Unintended double entendre.
Yes.
I mean, where do you think the term chicks came from?
Chicks.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, the Walfin is the one that I flip flopped on several times since you said it. False killer whale. Can I have more information about the false killer whale?
It's a whale that looks like a killer whale, but it's not a killer whale, so they call it a false killer
How big
whale.
Is it?
You
know, okay.
The size of a killer whale.
Okay, that one is science. when Steve goes, that's science. and this last one, the dromedary.
That's a camel.
And the, yeah, I know.
Okay, just checking.
I've seen movies.
Okay.
You've never seen a camel in real life?
No. He was pretending I didn't know what the word dromedary meant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But have you seen a camel in real life?
Of course.
I rode
a camel.
Me too.
Yes. They're cool.
It's not fun though.
Camels totally always seem a little pissed off.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Right?
Yeah, they have attitudes.
Yeah,
right?
Sometimes they just sit down
while you're riding them. They're just like, I'm going to sit down.
And do you ever see their feet? When their feet hit, they kind of smush. They go, meh. You know, they hit the sand.
So they go walk on the sand.
It's really interesting.
In Morocco.
I can buy that one. I don't see why, you know, without a lot of more, you know, more information. I mean, as soon as I Google this, I'll know. So I think I'm going to say, so it's going to be yes, yes, yes. I'm going to say the turkey does not exist.
Huh.
Okay. Bob?
Spread out. You want to go with the camel, Bob?
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to, some of these, actually none of these would surprise me. It's like any of these could be true. Who the hell knows? So I'm going to go with, sometimes I have to resort to, if a turkey existed, I think we would have heard of it. The other ones, not necessarily, but a turkey, that's just too awesome not to write about. I think I would have come across it. So I'm going to agree with Jay and say that turkey is fiction. That based on that, and you guys kind of thought it might be fiction as well. So those two together, that's the fiction.
So we got Walfin, geep, and two turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, all right. So let's see if we influence the audience. We'll do that very quickly. If you think that the geep is the fiction, clap.
Oh, they know about the geep. Damn it.
If you think that the turkey's the fiction, clap. If you think the walfin is the fiction, clap.
It's even.
And if you think that the comma is the fiction, clap. So you guys did not move them at all. They just completely discounted.
How many sheep farmers are there in the audience?
All right.
Sheep lies.
We were looking at photos last night of our trip, because part of our group is leaving tonight. And I accidentally had the show's photos were mixed in with the photos.
So did you see that?
Oh.
Yeah. And this thing came up.
Aww.
You saw that, Evan, right?
I did, but I forgot.
That is a geep.
It's so cute.
That's a geep. It's half goat.
I'm not even mad about being wrong.
Oh, my God. No wonder you reacted so strongly.
I'm like,
whoa, let's go past that one.
It's so cute.
It's cute.
I want one.
So geeks are real.
I love that.
So
that's a long torso. Look at that.
I know, right? It's a little.
Do people? Well, I guess they wouldn't eat them. Same thing. It's not.
They're very hard to produce.
Yeah.
They're very hard to produce, but you can produce them. And when they do produce, they're viable.
But do you think people more keep them as pets?
Because I've sent multiple pictures of them, and they're extremely variable, which is often the case.
That's typical
with hybrids.
Some dog breeds are like that. The combination breeds are
very unpredictable.
They're not stable. Right, they're not stable.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see another picture. The Walfin. This is a Walfin.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. Also highly variable. So it's a bottlenose dolphin and this false killer whale. The teeth are extremely variable. I saw some pictures of them that have like the killer whale teeth, you know. Kara's right, and they're very, very close. There's all cetaceans, and their offspring are actually viable.
That is a huge mouth, man.
And they're firm.
But they just.
And these are big.
Their populations just don't cross.
They look big.
They could, they do. They exist in the wild.
But I mean, there aren't like huge populations.
No, there's not populations. So it's just an occasional thing.
The comma. the common. Yeah.
You see that in birds a lot as well. Like you'll see occasional crossings of species that are close but that don't typically breed. And usually what happens is they just start to breed with their back populations, and so the genes just get
diluted. Yeah.
Back in. But of course, like humans and chimpanzees, right? So there were human chimps, you know, 5 million years ago, but they stayed separate, and those genes got just
That's kind of why, because dolphins have culture, and they have a lot of these more kind of self-limiting things, so it would be interesting to see if eventually a population
behaviorally, they just don't...
I wonder if they discriminate. I wonder if they discriminate against
them. No, they're very popular. They're very popular. Yep. Well, they have tremendous singing voices.
So we're left with the turkey
comma.
And the comma.
Show me a comma. Show me a comma.
What picture are we going to see?
Wait.
Comma.
Is the next one the science?
The next one is the science.
I'm going to show you
it's
a picture.
Be the comma.
There's either going to be a comma or a turkey up there.
Or a very bad drawing that you did.
Ready?
Yeah. Come on. Comma.
Comma.
Yes.
Turkey.
Yeah, baby.
That's adorable.
That is amazing.
So it was difficult to get them... To cross them because the camels are 6 times bigger than llamas. So they had to do artificial insemination.
Sure. Oh, okay.
And there's no intermediary species. Like with dogs, Chihuahuas and
Great Danes
can breed through intermediaries. They can exchange genetic material.
Wait,
there's
what?
No intermediaries? Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Size-wise.
Chihuahua and a Saint Bernard.
No, you just do two,
and a Saint Bernard.
Two generations.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Their offspring could, whatever.
Well, this makes sense that this is artificial insemination because camels have no game.
So why would they bother to do this? So obviously llamas are used for their wool, but llamas are assholes, right?
Camels are assholes too.
But the llamas are much worse.
Really?
They're much worse.
Why? I didn't think that.
Carrie, you saw the attitude they were giving us.
I thought they were adorable.
I was not with you last week.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You're lucky.
I wasn't in any of those pictures.
It was horrible.
Wait, why are llamas assholes?
They're just hard to control. They spit. They're just nasty creatures.
Camels
are a lot bigger. So imagine a llama as big as a camel with the personality of a camel.
And nice fur.
So it would be easier to handle, and you get much, much more fur.
Much more fur. Wool. Yeah, that's the important part.
That's why they created the comma. Unfortunately, the commas have the personality of a llama.
But you can breed for personality.
At least the first generation.
But didn't you say they're not?
They're not fertile.
They're not fertile. So
the first thing that the comma said when it was born was like, "What the fuck am I?"
Sad.
Yep.
Now, there's no picture of a turkey because they don't... Well, I could have had a picture of a turkey, but I...
You should have drawn something.
Yeah. Really. You totally should have tried to fake it.
Draw your hand, with the...
So, a lot of references say that turkeys don't exist at all, but I did find a reference where they said that they were able, on this one situation, to get a chicken and a turkey to produce... a living offspring, but they're not really viable. Here's the problem. Chickens have 6 chromosomes.
That's a problem.
Turkeys have 9.
There you go.
Yeah,
and so the chromosomal mismatch is just too much. And literally, after making thousands of attempts, like thousands of eggs crossed between a turkey and a chicken, 99.99% of them don't have live offspring.
So there was one at one point?
Yeah, but it was all messed up.
So did it cluck or gobble?
Yes.
I don't think it lived long enough to cluck or gobble.
They actually said it made this like pathetic little squeak. Like it doesn't even really make a noise.
It's like very,
and its limbs were all screwed up.
It's like some horrid experiment.
Yeah. I'm reminded of the remake of The Fly.
Yeah, right.
So, the turkey.
So there's no viable offspring of a chicken and a turkey.
Good, okay.
Unfortunately. But it probably would be delicious.
It would be delicious, I think. Yeah.
Which means, say it.
Which means? What?
Jay and I win.
Yes, you guys win.
So you got to say the words.
And most of the audience won.
Very anticlimactic.
No, I think I gave maybe 40% of the audience.
Yeah,
33. What happens when a New Zealander breeds with an Australian? Is that called something? It doesn't happen.
Never been a confirmed
case. So if you put that up there, that would have been the fiction.
Wait, what do Australians call like a bum kind of guy? Remember that Richard Saunders told us?
Yeah,
like a Bowden. A Bogan? A Bowden?
Something like Bodie. That.
Am I right? A Bowden? So let's make up a word right now. So it's like Key Bowden? Something like Bokey?
Bokey.
It's a Bokey.
Bowie.
Oh, Bogan.
A Bogan?
So it's a Bogey. A bogey. There we go.
There you go. Well done.
Yeah. That'll stick.
All right, we have time for a couple of quick questions.
Maybe one.
Is there a mic out in the audience? Here we go. Johnny's on it.
We never go to that slide.
Johnny on the spot.
Thank you, Mark.
The question is about the progression of bird evolution from dinosaurs, and maybe did it go the other way around? Yeah, are dinosaurs secondarily flightless? I read a science fiction book where they postulated that. So I think the very concept of progression is the wrong concept, because there is no progression in evolution. What we've discovered is you have theropod dinosaurs, which are small. Some got bigger, but they are feathered dinosaurs.
And they're the three-toed ones.
Yeah. So they look, they're very bird-like, and we're now discovering a lot of them were feathered. You know, they had downy feathers and whatnot.
Yeah, even T-Rex.
Yeah. Especially when they were young, they might have like the babies might have had downy feathers for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But in between theropod dinosaurs and modern birds, there is this massive bushy, you know, adaptive radiation of all kinds of feathered dinosaurs. There's no path, like straight line path from theropod dinosaurs to modern birds. And Archaeopteryx isn't even on the line to birds.
Just,
they're off in a side shoot somewhere.
Yeah,
there's
just a random.
Yeah, there's Microraptor with like four wings. There's birds with feathers that didn't fly. Then
four
birds
wings.
With flight feathers. Yeah, because like they're both forearms and their hind legs have feathers that they were kind of using
like
to glide. There's gliders. And then there's the ones where say, oh yeah, okay, this branch led to modern birds, you know. So you have to think of more of this sort of, you know, really complicated branching thing. And every time we find a new, you know, feathered dinosaur somewhere in that mix, it adds another complexity to it. You know what I mean?
But most of those things died.
Yeah. It's just that the one branch that led to modern birds is the only one that survived.
Exactly.
But it wasn't progressing towards that. It's just like horses. It's the same thing. Remember the false progression that was very famously like in the Natural History Museum in New York, which actually they kept it there. It was like, this is not real, but this is what we thought 100 years ago, where you have Eohippus and then progressively more modern horse-like, you know, members of that. So actually, these are not related. This is not a direct, like this did not evolve into that. These are just, you're just taking horse-like animals from all different branches of this adapting bush, and then you're putting them in a fake line. It's also like human evolution, that classic progression from
drawing,
a knuckle walker to more that's not a real progression. We did not evolve from knuckle walkers. They're on a different branch.
But Steve, the only progression, though, was temporal, right? You take one from here and then another one way over here, but later. And
well, not,
one,
even,
right?
Not even. Because when you look at.
Not even, I mean, sort of.
When you look at a cladogram, though, lots of times you'll see that there are these like points at the beginning, which are common ancestors, and some are really long lines and some are really short lines because one offshoot will have only lasted 20,000 years, one will have lasted 5 million years.
Right, so you may have.
And it could just keep evolving on its own and eventually just die off.
So you may have one species of horse related, you know, animal that lost some of its toes, but it wasn't on the branch to modern horses.
Yeah, just
and that could have happened
earlier.
So some things happen multiple times because they're easy to happen genetically. Yeah. And so you see multiple branches independently. That's the analogous versus homologous thing. So they put like analogous traits into this fake progression because it looked superficially like a progression and one end result that we know happened because that's the surviving species.
And that's in many ways feathers. Like feathers, there's
same
a lot
thing.
Of complication.
A lot of complication. Yeah, so get rid of the progression meme out of your head when you're thinking about evolution. It's just a messy,
see what you
messy
started?
Bush. That was a great question.
But I think the reason Archaeopteryx is interesting and captures people's imagination, and I have it tattooed on my forearm, is because it actually has very dinosaur-like features and very bird-like features, and it was very difficult for people to figure out at the beginning where to put it.
It's got a bony tail. It has teeth.
It lacks the
adaptation to flight. There's lots of details where it's, you know, it is half dinosaur, half bird. Yeah. But it's just an offshoot. It's just clearly not on the straight line to modern birds.
Okay. Are we out of time?
We are.
Which society?
The question is society getting more or less skeptical? And I facetiously but honestly answered yes. I think that everything is happening. I do think that there are more skeptics in the world. I think that the skeptical community is growing. The skeptical community is maturing. It is better informed. We have better infrastructure. And I think that our tendrils, you know, on the interwebs are having a dramatic effect.
And the term itself, I think, has a little bit less baggage. It's not necessarily always equated with cynic, right? Have you a similar experience?
I think the real change has been that we have way more literature. You know, back in Carl Sagan's days, They weren't as nuanced as we are. You know, we have people that are specialized in different things, and we have way more outreach.
We have way better game, as it were, than we did 20 years ago.
There's so much more information out there.
But at the same time, there's a lot more misinformation out there as well. They're the other side, quote-unquote, you know, people who are promoting either cons or misconceptions or myths or belief systems, they're expanding because of social media, et cetera, as well. And so there's
the
more of everything
gap
out there.
The gap.
It's hard to say. It's hard to say what the ratio is.
I think it also ebbs and flows because there are these points. You can talk about like society as a whole moving, but you really can only do that in hindsight, especially when you have people who are in positions of like great influence and power that shift so quickly. So it looks, for example, like the American landscape right now is completely in the toilet. But I don't know if in 6 years looking back we're going to see that. Yeah, I think you kind of do the two-step and the three-step a lot.
Okay, last question.
Last question. I had this best food we've had in New Zealand. I had a blueberry lemon pancake for breakfast earlier in the week.
Your daughter was talking about that, too.
Yeah, we both had it. It was awesome.
This may be an unpopular opinion, but you guys have amazing butter. Like, your butter is the best butter.
Yeah.
So anything you butter is better here.
The French agree.
You know what I mean?
The French agree.
They have better butter in New Zealand.
Plus, your coffee is profoundly good.
That's quite a statement from me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge coffee freak show, and I
big
coffee,
freak show.
Yeah,
very freaky.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Fantasy is escapist, and that is its glory. If a soldier is imprisoned by the enemy, don't we consider it his duty to escape? If we value the freedom of mind and soul, if we're partisans of liberty, then it's our plain duty to escape and to take as many people with us as we can. J.R.R. Tolkien.
Can I say one more thing? Guys, your country is so unbelievably beautiful. I mean, I've been to many places around the world. I thought Hawaii was beautiful. Hawaii has nothing on the South Island. You guys are really lucky.
It's magic.
Please appreciate it, because I spoke to many of you, and you're like, yeah, get used to it. The beauty is amazing, and this is the second time we're here. Craig, thank you so much. Johnny, thank you so much. These two guys made this whole thing
Thank you, guys.
Happen.
Yeah.
New Zealand skeptics.
Yeah, I have to say, even our night sky sucks. What the hell? It's
no,
so...
No, that we're just used to.
And,
we did get to see the southern sky, and it was third time in the southern hemisphere, first time I saw a clear, dark southern sky, and it was amazing. We saw the Magellanic Clouds and Alpha Centauri.
Orion upside down.
Upside down Orion. We proved conclusively that the Earth is a sphere with our personal observations.
More importantly, I wanted to thank Susie, because Susie, you're a great... You're a great MC, you're funny, you're smart, and you're beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.